I did.
That's what I keep saying.
This is 2 evenings in a row with you, Scott.
Huh?
This is 2 evenings in a row with you.
Yes, we're hanging out. Who orders some pizza?
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come back to order. I've talked with Senator Tomassoni since we left because there are a number of amendments to the bill and because the House has merged its bill in with the omnibus bill and because of the fact that there are lots of interactive parts with it in the omnibus bill. So we are not going to take that bill up tonight. We will, Senate File 936, we will take up those amendments and other things on it later and then fold that into omnibus bill next week, I guess. But we're going to take up Senate File 570, and that one will travel on its own. And so with that, Senator Tomassoni, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I know this isn't the first committee this has been through, but I have an A1 amendment to clean up the language that is in the bill. Do you want to put that on first?
Yeah, we will deal with that. Well, why don't you start explaining the bill, because I'm not sure if it's in the packets.
It is in the packet.
Well, then, Senator Hoffman moves the A1 amendment. This is not technically first. This is not first committee. Do you want to explain the amendment? And
Mr. Chairman, as I looked at it, I think what it did was it makes the bill read the way it's supposed to read. And so it is just,
it's a technical amendment.
Yeah, it's sort of technical, yeah.
Is there any discussion on the Hoffman motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
It's
Chairman and committee members. So,
members,
Senate File 570 requires the use of 5% of the cost provided by the state in bonding for construction projects or major renovation to be used for Made in Minnesota solar PV modules. And this is an effort that would require reasonable state investment in renewable energy on the state buildings moving forward. Similar legislation passed the House on a bipartisan basis in 2012. And Senate File 570 defines Made in Minnesota manufacturing by certifying solar PV modules in the factories producing these products through Underwriters Laboratory 1704 standards. The solar systems on these state buildings are limited to a maximum of 40 kilowatt in size, and currently the maximum investment at current solar installation costs would not be more than $200,000 to $250,000. The commissioner must establish criteria for awarding the solar energy systems and including the system's life cycle costs, fire safety ratings, and innovative energy features. And, Mr. Chairman, we have a similar provision in law already that is not a mandate, and it says that the administration can do this already. This says that we'd like to see you do it for everything that is anything new, and I think it's a really good way to get our state buildings in a green mode and have them using solar panels and putting up solar systems for their new buildings. It's easier to do it on new buildings than it is to renovate, but at the same time it ends up saving all the taxpayers money on their energy costs. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to my witness.
Yes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Shaver. I'm the president of Silicon Energy Minnesota and also Silicon Energy. I am testifying today in support of Senate File 570. Silicon Energy started out in Washington State in 2007, just north of Seattle. In 2010, we broke ground in Mountain Iron, Minnesota, so on the range. We are a facility that has recognized the IBEW for its bargaining unit. Our focus as a company is on a product of the highest durability and highest quality in the market, the highest safety, and we're looking for products that can be integrated into buildings or onto buildings to have a very strong, good look to them. In addition to our company's focus in on the quality and durability, we have the backing of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which we recently received our testing reports from them, and we came out as the top module for durability of all tested. And you can see that information on our website. I'm sorry I don't have that for you today. There is a packet that describes a little bit about our company and our product. But what that basically did was is our federal government, through Department of Energy testing, has shown our product to be just the best out there. Our companies, in addition to focusing in on a great product, we're very focused in on being a good partner to the regions that we do business in. And we intend and have done that here in Minnesota. We're focused in on economic development. Solar is a great way to develop the economy. Job creation is part of that. We're really focused in on being a long-term supporter of the local economy, so we try very hard whenever we can to buy locally. If we can't get it locally, we go regionally and in the U.S. Right now, our components on a component count is roughly 85 to 90% U.S. content. That is the focus that I want our company on, is supporting our local economy. The other focus that we have is a participant in energy security for the United States and national security in bringing small distributed generation to our local communities to improve the infrastructure that utilities have, and on a national security to prevent any large-scale attack that could occur on our grid through the distribution of that. So we have a product that's locally made for economic development. High durability and quality is what we're really focused in on. And I respectfully ask your support of Senate File 570. Thank you.
Well, by the way, you said you're from Silicon Energy, not our agenda says 10K solar, but you're, that's your
I don't
competitor.
Think they'd be terribly happy with me running their company right now.
Questions from the committee. If not, Mr. Hinkle, is he here still? If not, Peter Paris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I did have a question for the testifier.
For this question?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Shaver, she did have a question for you.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I apologize.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shaver, this is a nice brochure, and I want to just draw the attention to the solar incentives that are inside the brochure. It includes the federal incentive and a little description about the solar rewards program, the Minnesota Power Rebate Program, on and on. And I think this pretty much covers all the solar initiatives out there. How many folks are employed at Silicon Energy?
Presently, we have about 10 at the facility, and we just brought on an additional person here in the Twin Cities 2 days ago for our outside sales and marketing.
And if you don't mind, can you explain why you chose Mountain Iron? Is it that?
Mountain Iron? Iron? Right. I think the history of the range is maybe the senator would like to speak to this.
Well, she got to know why you chose.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say economic development. So the range is an area, as we all know, that is looking to increase its employment. And there was an opportunity. There was already an energy park that was being developed. Our parent company had previous relationships in projects in the area, and it just seemed like a win-win for everybody. So that's why we chose to go to Mountain Iron.
Okay.
Further questions for Mr. Shaver? Thank you. Mr. Paris, or is Lynn Hinkle here?
They're not here.
Okay.
Yes, they're not here.
Okay. Is there anybody else who wished to testify on the bill? Is there a discussion from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomassoni, would this bill require solar for this Capitol building?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, I've been asked that question, and I think we've been told by the Cap Board people that solar won't fit on the Capitol, and I think based on that, we wouldn't want to do anything like that. And if there needs to be some kind of an amendment to put in the bill to make it comfortable, I think that'd be fine too. But I don't think that. I've been told by the, admin has also had the same concern, so I don't have any intention of requiring that.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomassoni, but your bill does mandate that any bonding projects for state buildings, it mandates that they take solar, is that correct?
That's, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, that's correct, yes.
So, Senator Tomassoni, before the bill's even passed, you already want to start doing carve-outs and making exceptions to your bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, if you don't want to, I won't mind not doing it, but I think that at some point in time when you pass a bill like this, you have to be cognizant of where it will work and where it won't work, and if it doesn't fit on the roof of the Capitol, then I don't think we want to put them there.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Tomassoni, I'm just curious as to why then we're going to mandate it in your bill if we know that it's not going to work everywhere.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm being told, Senator Brown, that the bill that was passed last year has already made the Capitol as an exception, so apparently it's already taken care of.
Further, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Tomassoni, why are we eliminating the cost-benefit analysis provision?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I believe because it's a mandate now. Is that correct? Or?
So regardless of how much additional cost, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, regardless of how much additional cost to the taxpayers, we're going to go forward no matter what.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Sirkvenik for the tape representing Silicon Energy. The reason it is eliminated in the bill in front of you is it's inserted in Section E on the last page where the commissioner must establish criteria, including the life cycle cost on a per kilowatt basis. So it was redundant. So it's not being eliminated. It is in the bill in Section E.
Mr. Chair, actually, all this does is ask the commissioner to evaluate systems presented to him. It doesn't say that the one that's chosen has to provide a cost benefit to the facility it's being installed on. And so, Mr. Chair, if Senator Tomassoni could address that.
Senator Tomassoni.
No, I can't, because I think Mr. Cervenic answered the question, so I guess I'm not sure what you're pointing to here.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Tomassoni, there's only so much money to spend on renovating buildings. And if solar is going to, you know, pay back over 15 years, save electric costs, et cetera, then it would pass a cost-benefit analysis. If it's not going to pay back in a reasonable amount of time, then we're spending taxpayer dollars on something that's not going to gain any benefit or even be neutral. Even if solar was neutral, there are intangible reasons to do it. And so I think this is adding burden to already limited dollars to complete construction projects across the state.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bench, this is similar to the ARC requirement in bonding bills, and this one is actually going to end up saving taxpayers' money in the end. It's limited, so it can't be any bigger than 40 kilowatts. And so I think the fact of the matter is that it's cognizant of some of the things you're bringing up, and it's actually addressing them in the limits in the bill.
Senator Tomassoni, on that, maybe it's not related exactly to what she was asking, but on line 18 of the second page, that exceeding the 5% maximum set by paragraph C, to the extent the system leverages other sources of funding, is the intent of that in other words, if a project is $10 million, 5% would that be $500,000? It could exceed that to the extent it gets other funding to exceed that. I mean, it's not clear here. I assume if the amount of bonding for a project is $10 million, you can't just up it beyond that without higher bonding. Are you saying that, in other words, if of the $500,000 that would be set aside for this, if for $800,000 they can get $300,000 more money?
Yeah.
I'm not clear what you're
saying.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I think it all depends on the cost of the 40 kilowatt, because it doesn't go past the 40 kilowatt, and then the line you're referring to would then state that if somebody else wanted to pay for it besides the bonding bill, that they could put more on.
So maybe I'll ask Senate Counsel on that, but it looks to me like you might need to clarify that language a little bit, because it looks like, and I don't know that it would work that way, but you could say if you had $10 million in bonding for a building, and you're saying here it could exceed 5% of that $10 million to the extent it leverages other sorts of funding. I mean, I don't know how you'd get more money for it if you bonded for $10 million, so... That's, I guess I'm asking, in other words, you could exceed the 5% if you got outside funding to cover 6%, 7%, 8%.
I think that's it.
You might need a clarification.
Let me have Mr. Vanek address
Senator Osmak had a question or a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Tomasoni. Senator Benson sort of started on the track I was going on. I don't understand why, you know, you said at the end of your statement that this is to save money for the taxpayers at the beginning just a few minutes ago. And taking out the cost-benefit analysis doesn't tell us if this makes sense economically. And by removing that, you don't know before the project starts if it actually is going to make economic sense. And I understand you're pointing to line 2.25, talking about objective criteria. But that doesn't say doing a cost-benefit analysis. It doesn't talk about, is this going to economically make sense? Is this going to save money for the taxpayers? Is it going to actually produce a financial benefit? All that statement on 2.25 says is creating objective criteria for actually awarding the solar energy system. It doesn't talk about what are we going to save. So I would respectfully say that not having the cost-benefit analysis in here doesn't give us any idea if it makes any economic sense. Do you disagree or agree?
Well, I think the intent of that paragraph is to have the commissioner decide if it makes sense, and that's what it's there for. And objective criteria would be deciding whether or not it makes sense. So I think that's what that's there for. And I don't know, maybe Mr. Savannah can clear that up or not, but I believe that what we're shooting for here is that the commissioner make a decision based on the criteria that would make sense for putting these things on buildings.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, it doesn't say here that part of the criteria that he's going to be doing, because it talks about criteria used for the life cycle. It doesn't direct the commissioner at all to be checking to see, is this going to make economic benefit? Is this going to be actually saving the taxpayers' dollars? And does the cost-benefit analysis actually prove that it's going to save money? So further down in Section E, it really doesn't describe that. It talks about fire safety. But it doesn't explicitly say that. So from what I'm reading here, there is no requirement for cost-benefit analysis. They could just move on. The commissioner can move on his merry way without actually doing that step of the process.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Osmak, I believe the language gives the commissioner the ability to do something like that if he decides to. And the bill itself would require that the solar panels are put on the buildings. The commissioner has to decide exactly how and where and why. And so I think there's latitude here for the commissioner to make some decisions.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'll have to disagree with you, Senator Tomasoni. Just giving the commissioner to do something if he wants to, I don't think is our responsibility. If we're saying that this is going to actually save money for the taxpayers, which is what you said in your statement, then we should require the commissioner to show that it's going to save money for the taxpayers, which would be requiring the cost-benefit analysis.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, I'm interested in the statement you made, too, that this ultimately is going to save taxpayers money. I'm very interested in that. Could you expound upon exactly how this is going to save taxpayer money?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should have my solar experts explain that to you, but the fact is that when you use solar panels, you don't buy electricity from electrical companies because you're getting the power from the electrical panels, and those are the savings right there. So I think it's pretty clear, but I'll let Mr. Go ahead, Gary.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. So what we're looking at is the operations cost of your facilities. So over time, as long as you've invested in a product that has a lifetime that can deliver, then you can look at that as a long-term asset to the state that will help in reducing the operating costs of your building. not only the electricity, it depends on how you install this system. You may use it as, you could use it as shading structures on the side of a building, which would further increase the payback, reduce the payback time to the state, and reduce the operating costs for your HVAC for a building. That's one or two possible things that you could do with this.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Gary Shaver.
Mr. Shaver. So let's say, for instance, just as a hypothetical, we put solar for the Capitol building here. What would the cost for a project like that be for the state Capitol building?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. So that one is going to—it's going to really depend upon what it is that you're wanting to achieve. Are you wanting this to be on a flat roof? There's some variables that are going to go into this. Is it going to go on the side of the building? There are going to be some construction costs that would go into that.
I'm looking at the, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the ultimately being savings to taxpayers. So if we add up what the cost to buy the system is and include the subsidies over the course of time and how long these panels last before they have to be replaced, I'm just curious to find out at what point do we see the cost savings to taxpayers? How many years does that play out to before we actually see the cost savings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, to kind of on a hypothetical system put onto the Capitol, if it had the proper or if it had good orientation, good performance characteristics, you could look at a system that would return within let's say somewhere around 13 to 15 years. Potentially, and in the lifetime with our product, speaking specifically to that, we've been tested out. Well, we have a warranty of 30 years on that. As far as the entire installed cost, again, kind of using that as a simplified hypothetical, I think it would be in that range that I just mentioned.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shaver, the bill is very tightly crafted, and if there was a state building that perhaps could use some other kind of renewable, I'm not sure why we're, again, making winners and losers here with just solar, because if you really do want to talk about cost savings, we should be, and everybody knows that, the deals in energy, everybody in this room knows, if you're truly talking about cost savings, it's about conservation. That's where you're going to see the best bang for your buck. And so talking that this is going to be a cost savings going forward, I beg to differ, and I think that's why we have to have that cost-benefit analysis in there to make sure that we are, this investment is going to make the returns. But if we're talking about doing renewables for state buildings because that's where we want to lead this state, then we should break this open to geothermal, wind, algae growth on the top of, we could do all sorts of different things, but just to have a bill for solar seems a little disingenuous.
Senator Rosen, I think on the question of other renewables being used in the building, I'm not against that. In fact, in this bill, there's actually a section that allows, again, it's solar, but this is solar thermal. And that is in, I don't have the line number here, but it's on the second page. But it does allow, I think it's 221 on the second page, does allow solar thermal to be included in. Solar just works so well in a built environment, buildings like this. You can bring it in to the building, integrate it into the building safely and effectively. That's why solar is such a great choice for it. As far as the efficiencies moving forward, there's no doubt that having efficient running buildings is part of the equation. But the 2030 challenge by the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, has clearly pointed out that they have done just about everything in efficiency and developing efficient equipment and things that can be added into an envelope, that they can't reach those challenges without going into active generation. And that's where solar, PV, and solar thermal can play into that and bring even greater savings and operating cost. Thank you.
Mr. Shaver.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're all stumbling today.
I'm getting confused, too.
Sorry. Mr. Shaver, what else could play into it besides solar thermal, solar panels?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen.
What else did the report show?
Excuse me?
What else did the report show that could play into?
The report was primarily the discussions that are going on with the IAA right now are that they have made significant strides in building envelope efficiency, and that the curve of the efficiency gains are now, the slope is now becoming horizontal to where now they're needing to take it over to the active. So the focus on that was the typical insulation conservation means, variable speed pump controls of that nature, and then looking to how do you overcome that that final remaining bit that conservation does not look like it will be able to achieve.
So, Mr. Chair, so Mr. Shaver, what are we trying to achieve? We have a renewable energy standard that we are meeting. We're meeting our goals right now. So I'm not sure what else we need to. I think we're leaders in the nation on our conservation push, and we should be very proud of the programs that we set up for that. So I'm not quite sure what else we can do.
Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about the strikeout of that cost-benefit analysis and talking with Mr. Knopf. I would offer the following oral amendment. On line 2.12, reinsert the stricken language. On line 2.13, reinsert the stricken language and strike the word shall.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomasoni.
Senator Osbeck, let's do this.
I feel a deal coming.
reinstate all the stricken language except for the may and leave the shall in there, and we have a deal.
Mr. Knapp, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, the only addition I think I would make to Senator Thomasoni's suggestion is if you put a, you could put the word positive after the reinstated stricken A on line 212. I don't know if you wanted to deal with it or you just wanted to do the. What if it shows a negative cost-benefit analysis?
I would up the ante, Mr. Chair, that I would accept the shall with the positive with the word positive inserted before the word the letter A on page on line 212.
I'll accept the compromise.
Fair enough. Right.
Senator Osmick moves reinstate the stricken language on line 12. 2.12 and page 2 and line 13, insert positive before cost-benefit analysis, which would not be stricken. And so it would read, after the completion of a positive cost-benefit analysis, shall include. That's your amendment?
Yes, it is.
Senator Osmick moves it.
Wait, before we do this, Mr. Chairman, yes. Because it just occurs to me that what do you mean by positive?
I can speak to that.
In other words, what your witness was saying was 12 to 13, 14 years, whatever he said. I presume that's positive, but that does beg the question if it was over 200 years, or that may not be quite as positive.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm okay with it, but
Mr. Knopf,
I mean, 15 and a half years might be positive, but 15 and three quarters might not be. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, what does positive mean? We should be probably satisfied with just a cost-benefit analysis and let the department make a decision, but because I don't know what the word positive actually means. But Senator Osmick, what are you thinking?
I can speak to that. A positive cost-benefit analysis is where you take all of the costs and all the projected savings and you do a simple division of the two, and if the or a simple comparison of the two, as if the total costs, I mean, at one point in time, it becomes obsolete. It becomes to the point where it has to be taken out. So you don't want to include the costs of replacement after it's already past its lifespan. But for the lifespan, to install it, to maintain it, there's costs. Then there's the savings that you're going to see based on all of the energy savings. The difference between the two, if it's a positive number, means you have more savings than cost. That's what
I mean
by positive.
If you're comfortable with it, I'm comfortable with it.
Okay. Senator Osmick's amendment, is everybody clear what it is? Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many manufacturers currently qualify for the Made in Minnesota on line 1.9?
Senator Senator Thomas, Mr. Shaver.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, presently there are two manufacturers in Minnesota, but with the program, with the programs that are being presented the last couple days, I anticipate that to increase.
And Mr. Chair, I presume that the two companies are represented on either side of Senator Tomasoni advocating for this bill?
No, they're both the same one, but there's another
one here. They're the same company. There is one more. Okay. All right. Seems like a pretty narrow focus, and generally companies that are already established have a significant advantage over startups. So let's just be clear about who benefits.
I'm sorry, did I hear Senator Thomas?
I think we're ready to go, Mr. Chairman.
I did have a thing that I think we should clarify, that language on 2.18 about the exceeding 5%, because I assume this is what you're intending, and I think that's what you said, but if there's a $10 million project, and I don't know how much a 40-kilowatt project costs, but 5% would be $500,000. And then that case, when you have this language, can exceed 5% to the extent the system leverages other sources of funding. You're saying it wouldn't be more than 5% of the bonding money, but it might be more than 5% of the project cost if you get outside funding. Is that correct?
That's the way I read it, Mr. Chairman, yes. And I think that for purposes of the 5%, that the 40 kilowatts would be the maximum that you could go, and so the 5% might not even be 5%.
Right, I understand. Maybe 2% bigger project would be less. Yeah. Mr. Fuller has some language that might clarify that, because I don't think that line 18 is very clear, and maybe I'll have him read that, and you can see if you feel reasonable.
Mr. Chair, members, I think the issue is what limits the bond proceeds appropriation. How much is the bond proceeds fund liable for? And the thought is 5%. And I think to make that explicit, you could insert after building on line 21, no more than 5% of bond proceeds fund appropriations for a project may be expended on a solar energy system required by this section.
So, in other words, you'd have 5% of the bonding money could go to that if it costs that much for a 40-kilowatt system, but if it could be more than 5% if you get outside funding, in other words, based on line 18. Is that what your intent is?
Let me see here. Okay, Mr. Fuller, since we put must not back in.
Senator Tomasoni.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Shaver.
Maybe I can answer that. So I think what that line is trying to say is that that the state can leverage potential tax equity investors that can match that system and increase that system size, which would be an even greater benefit to the state. They could bring it in excess of that. I think that's what that line is to do.
Well, what, go ahead,
what,
Senator
well, what did Mr. Fuller just say?
Mr. Fuller,
I didn't understand what he said.
there's nothing in the bill now, which is probably made necessary by amendment, that says that the expenditures from the bond proceeds fund are limited at 5%. Right. Because it says the cost can exceed that if you leverage it. It doesn't say that any of that cost can be paid for by bond fund appropriations.
Mr. Fuller, doesn't line C, the cost of the solar system must not exceed 5% of the appropriation from the bond proceeds? Isn't that it?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator, no, because there's an exception.
Well, what the exception is if they get outside funds.
Senator,
Mr. Fuller.
What did you just say?
Don't want to beat a dead horse, Mr.
Well,
Chair.
Well, no, but Mr. Fuller, go ahead and read your amendment again, because I didn't follow it, and I think if it's,
there is,
it's probably okay.
There's nothing in here that says that. If you look at line 19, the cost of the solar system used to say must not exceed 5%. Now it says may exceed 5%.
No, we changed it.
I know, now it says
must not. No, but it says must not again.
Did you? In the
because we reinstated must not.
But there's still an exception in there. right?
Except
there's no exception if
that exception doesn't limit the use of bond proceeds funds above 5%. I mean, that may be your intent. There's nothing in the bill that says that once you leverage other outside money, then the exception applies. Then that doesn't say that you can't use some additional bond proceeds money.
Well, it's just the logic. Okay, reread the amendment because I just didn't understand what you added in there.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. Page 2, line 21, after building a new sentence. No more than 5% of bond proceeds fund appropriations for a project may be expended on a solar energy system required by this section. I mean, if that's not that's an absolute limit.
Okay, that's fine. That's clear to me.
Clear as mud to me now. Somebody want to offer that amendment then?
So moved.
Senator Hoffman moves that amendment. The one that Mr. Fuller just read about three times, that on line 21 of page 2, no more than 5% of bond proceed fund appropriations for a project may be expended on a solar energy system required by this section. Senator Dibble.
Hate to backtrack us, but it does feel like we're just simply restating the first sentence because that must not language was restored. So the paragraph now reads, the cost of the solar system must not exceed 5% of the appropriations from the bond proceeds, etc. You know, except as provided in paragraph B, and then we say again, no more than 5% of the bond proceeds can fund. You know, because in the A1 amendment, we restored that must not language.
Yep.
And we deleted the new language.
I think it was 8.
I lost track of one of the things. What? He's saying that the exception in the first line is the one that's exceeded by you can exceed the 5% in paragraph C in the line above it. And so his language would say, well, you can spend more than 5% of that value on the solar system, you can't expend more than 5% of the bond proceeds of it.
I see.
I think it's kind of awkward way of saying it, but
it probably all should be wrapped together in one.
Yeah, maybe we
shouldn't be separated, but it's fine if it works. Okay, I get it.
This is going to another committee. Maybe
right.
Somebody can fix that.
Mr. Chair, I think, and I'm sure Mr. Fuller will correct me, but on line 2.18, that exception means that if you could leverage 7.5% or 10% of the bonding money to get the solar, I think that's what Mr. Fuller's kind of absolute amendment allows, because line 2.19, while it has the must, it has except as provided above. And so if there was some federal program that said if you bring in X amount of dollars, we'll dump in half, I think that's what Mr. Fuller's second amendment fixes.
It's not expressed well. The two paragraphs probably need to be reworked. I think we should ask
before, if this is moving forward to the next committee, that we ask Senate Counsel to look for a clearer way to state this. Senator, the intent is, let's make sure we agree on the intent first.
All right. Here's what I think the intent is. The intent is to not put more than 40 kilowatts on the building, and if 40 kilowatts is... or if 5% is 40 kilowatts is more than 5%, then you don't spend the 5%. If 5% is less than 40 kilowatts, then you spend the 5%. And if somebody wants to put in some outside money, then whoever is building the building can put more than 40 kilowatts on the building, but the bond proceeds won't spend more than 5% or 40 kilowatts on that particular solar panel, and that the extra above 5% or above the 40 kilowatts, whichever is greater, is spent on the outside sources, by outside sources.
Paid for by some other source.
That's what the intent is, I believe.
I think that's what the amendment Mr. Fuller proposed, that Senator Hoffman moved, that Senator Mr. Fuller drafted. I think that will accomplish in a very awkward way, and maybe we can ask somebody to clean up later. On the Hoffman amendment, now that everybody might understand it, any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill?
You're doing Made in Minnesota.
Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 570 is amended. Recommended pass. Referred to finance or capital investment? Where does it go first?
I think it goes to capital investment. Is capital investment under finance, or isn't it?
Division of finance.
No, it's not. It's separate.
It's separate. Is that fine?
It could probably go either way.
Send it to capital investment, and we'll go from there.
Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 570 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Is there further discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Senator Dahl, we had several other bills related to power line siting earlier today. You missed the thrill of the afternoon session. Glad to have you here.
Mr. Chair, thank you for having us, and I'm sorry I missed the excitement. This bill, Senate File 183, is also known as by the Farm Statute, and while I had prepared some opening remarks, I'm going to take some excerpts as my introduction out of former Senator Gene Merriam's testimony, and I think it's a handout that if you don't have... I think you should have.
It is in the packets.
Great. So let me just highlight a couple of those things before I get to our testifiers who will explain the bill and then give you the reasons why we need this important legislation. Some historical context. Since the end of the Vietnam War protests of the 60s and 70s, there's been no greater civil unrest in the state over the past 40 years than the power line protests of West Central Minnesota during the mid-70s. Contentious meetings, often vociferous, angry, unruly crowds, necessitating a substantial law enforcement presence. Power line towers under construction were vandalized, and in a couple of instances, as Gene recalls, they were toppled. So the Senate chair, the majority leader of the time, Nick Coleman, asked Gene Merriam to put together some legislation that might address the issue. And he says a related underlying cause was the power imbalance between the affected farmers and the power companies. The 1977 law changes contain several provisions prompting to better balance the relationship between those whose property was being taken or adversely impacted and those who were responsible for that action. So that is indeed what was born out of those meetings was the By the Farm statute. Last paragraph on that page, we recognize that it was necessary for the greater public good to allow power companies to continue to exercise eminent domain, provide electricity to the customers, but we also recognize we need to make the outcome more fair. We heard from some farmers that did not want to continue living and farming with a hated power line tower in their view, sometimes having to run their equipment around it. If the power company needed to run a high voltage power line across their property, the landowner could compel the power company to condemn the entire property. By the Farm statute also cross-references sections of Chapter 117, the eminent domain law, because they intended to that once a landowner had elected to buy the farm, the owner would be treated the same as any property owner whose entire property had been condemned at the outset. And as you know, A lot of those provisions were updated in 2006. And originally, utilities were exempt from those provisions, but when I was here last in the Senate in 2010, by a 59-5 vote in the Senate and a 142-7 vote in the House, we made sure that the power companies, the utilities, were also included in eminent domain proceedings. Continuing on here, we recognize that the ancillary costs under the eminent domain laws might lead to slightly more costs to the power company, who simply pass it on to their customers. But under the doctrine of fairness, we recognize that the costs of relocation were there without regard to this law. It was simply a matter of deciding whether it was more fair to have these costs borne by the innocent farmer or the electrical power customers. Not too surprising, but disappointing, nevertheless, the power companies litigated and appealed the By the Farm law all the way to the Supreme Court. We were gratified that the Supreme Court not only upheld that law, but described it as a creative legislative solution. Well, we're here now again because we're also seeing litigation. One lower court sided with the property owners on what By the Farm statute actually means. An appeals court sided with the power companies, and now it's in the Supreme Court. And you're probably asking, well, why don't we let the courts decide this? Regardless, this statute needs defining, and my testifiers today will talk about why we need to update the By the Farm statute, which has worked so well for so long. I think I'll turn it over to Kurt Schnitker, who represents several of those landowners across my district and many of your districts.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dahl, Chairman Marmy, members of the committee. My name is Kirk Schnitker, and I'm an attorney, and I practice in the area of eminent domain and real estate law. I'm president of the Minnesota Eminent Domain Institute, an organization that supports this legislation. This bill provides by the farm involves the By the Farm statute that permits those in the path of high-voltage power lines to elect to have their entire property taken. The state legislature passed the By the Farm legislation for several reasons. To ensure landowners were not burdened by these very large high-voltage power lines. To give owners of property that are impacted by these power lines the avenue to move. It also ensured that individual property owners subjected to the taking did not carry the burden for projects intended as for the public as a whole. Currently, there is a very large expansion of high-voltage utility lines across Minnesota on different corridors that are intended for the public as a whole. The entity that's commonly called CapEx is a coalition of many utilities. What's happened in many of these matters is we've seen an intensive amount of litigation involving landowners when the landowners do exercise their right to have the utility acquire their entire farm. The problems that we've seen is significant problems and hardships that we've seen are extensive delays in the litigation and having the resolution made. If we look at some of the case law in the Assan case that Senator Dahl referred to, the court said it's a way of a property owner expeditiously having their property acquired, and that's hardly the case. One of our witnesses today, Brad Lindberg, will testify that it's been over 2 years. I think it's almost 2.5 years since he elected to have them take his farm, and they only recently had commissioners hearing to determine the valuation. They've made it clear that they're going to extensively litigate if it's not absolutely crystal clear some of the legal issues, and that creates a significant burden on the property owners. One of the problems that we've had, which is one of the really significant problems, is they've refused to make offers to purchase the property once there's been an election. And basically the position is, well, we don't really have to do that. We don't need to turn around and make an offer to do it yet because the law is not explicitly clear. In the Lindberg case, for example, it was over 2 years and we didn't even see an offer. One of the issues involved in the litigation only addresses a couple of issues, and that involves relocation benefits and minimum compensation benefits. So there's a lot of issues that could be involved and could be litigated unless we get some of these things straightened out. And that involves some of the issues. Relocation, for example, is something that these property owners absolutely need. Relocation is something that the state legislature has decided to adopt. They've adopted the federal rules that said that if you're going to be displaced, you're afforded relocation benefits. Two district court judges and one judge in the three-panel court of appeals said that those laws, that those relocation rights ought to be provided as minimum compensation as well. This bill, Senate File 183, helps to clarify this law and stop this endless litigation. It makes it clear that condemnees will be afforded the same eminent domain rights as any other condemnee is afforded and offered if their property is taken by the state. It makes it clear that when CapEx challenges a condemnee's election to have them buy the farm, there'll be a process as to the delays. So we hopefully don't end up with the delays like we have with Mr. Lindbergh, for example, where there will have to be a determination. We understand that there's probably going to be some cases where CapEx may say that an election is maybe unreasonable, but in those cases we want to have a significant process that's laid out as to how that would be litigated. Now, CapEx has argued that this legislation will be too costly. This is a $2.2 billion project. And based on our projections, as far as the numbers that this might impact those property owners that it might affect, this is probably going to cost them less than one-half of 1% to what we think to do is what the law already says that they need to do. But we have a clarification, nonetheless, that we need to get passed. If we don't have this, we're afraid that this is going to continue. This is going to result in continued litigation, and it's going to create additional hardships for property owners that will take years and years. Lastly, CapEx said this is wrong because Minnesota is the only state that has such a remedy for landowners. We don't see the basis for this criticism. We think it's good legislation, and we think that Senator Merriam's statement provides good rationale for why we have this. We urge you to vote for this bill as it gives a reasonable protection to landowners and simply clarifies what most believe is intended by the Buy the Farm Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schneider. Questions from the committee? If not, Ms. Schwartz.
Hi, my name is Julie Schwartz. We live by Arlington, Minnesota. We run a 100-cow dairy, my husband and I, Dale, with our children. And this line is coming across five of our six properties. As I said, we have 575 acres. Only one of them's not being affected. We have a driveway that's more than a third of a mile long. It's going down our driveway right along the property line along our farm site. We have eight poles on our property. These arms that stick out 15 feet from these tall poles, the line will be directly over our driveway. So every time we go in and out of our driveway, we will be underneath it. Every time we get our mail, every time we go to town, every time we go to the field, every time we haul manure, we will be going under this line. We went in hopes that we would find some information that we could stay on our dairy. We went out to Wisconsin to talk to some farmers out there that have cows the same distance away, except they have field in between. Our cows are roughly 400 feet away. We found out that they used to be top herd in their state, 27,000-pound herd average, low somatic cell. They went from 27,000 pounds down to 16,000. They had cows die, calves die, cows abort. It took 8 to 10 breedings to keep a cow pregnant. The husband himself, when the voltage reaches a certain point, his whole body broke out in a rash. His wife had some effects, but not that severe. Another issue that really concerns us, if this bill does not go through, the appraisal goes to the time our condemnation for the easement was done, which in our case is May 9th of 2012. At that time, CapEx is saying that our land in our area, pretty much everybody they've been saying is $7,000 an acre. We know of land very close to us that has now been going for $10,000 and $12,000 plus per acre. Part of our 160 acres that we did the BTF election on is under mortgage. I can guarantee that we cannot go to our lender and he's going to borrow us $500,000 to $1 million to keep our same land base. So this financially is going to make us go way backwards, and I don't even know if we will then have the choice to do the election because we couldn't afford it. And one other quick thing about my husband, he had a hip transplant, and in CapEx's information that they send out, they said it can affect pacemakers, implantable defibrillators, artificial limbs, screws, and pins. Unfortunately, my husband's on the Stryker recall, and we found out last week he has to have that replaced. And the doctor asked us, how far away is your house? And we said a little over 400 feet away, and he said, you're absolutely too close. And he didn't hesitate. That's what he said. We really need you to consider this bill. people that have tried, as Kurt Schnichter talked about, have been waiting to try and get some kind of compensation so they can move on with their lives. There's people like us that are in it, and there's so many people more that are going to be going through this that have no idea what they're going to be in for. This is four lines throughout our whole state that is dissecting our state. It's affecting so many people. We only ask that you support this. We are just asking for the law to be clarified. We're not asking for huge changes. We need your help now. Our lives depend on it. Please consider supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schwartz. Questions from the committee? I think we have Brad Winberg.
Dave Minner.
Dave Minner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, my name is Dave Minner. Our family farms down near New Prague, 2 miles north of New Prague in southern Scott County. We built a creamery on our farm 11 years ago yesterday. We started opening our business. I've been farming there since I was a youth. My grandfather bought the farm in 1926. We're faced with the power line coming right through right along County Road 2, which is adjacent to our farm. We have many acres of pasture that are going to be under the power lines, electric fences under the power lines. We're not sure how we're going to handle that. I understand that there's some filters that can be put on to alleviate that, but filters are man-made, and I'm not sure if I'm going to trust them. What happens when the filters fail? We have a lot of other issues. We're wondering about our soil. You know, we've been building soil for 20 years since we've been farming organically, and we're not sure if we can find another farm like the one we have right here. And this effect of the power line is going to be huge on our family. Several of our children are employed in the business, and it's going to have a huge effect. You know, we're talking about moving out, and you know, we've got, in order for us to find another farm, an organic farm, like, that would be virtually impossible. We farm about 440 acres of organic land. Just to help you understand that, cows that produce organic milk have to be fed an organic diet. Ours is a all forage diet, and in order for farmland to be certified organic and grow organic feed, it has to go through a 3-year conversion process. For us, this would be huge. I think it would virtually run us out of business if we had to move. So I'm asking you to support this bill. I consider it just justice for family farmers, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Bradley Lindberg. My wife, Linda, and I own and operate a 63-acre farm in Clearwater where we raise cattle, hogs, goats, horses, and hay. We have lived there for 23 years and raised our family there. Our farm has been crossed by the CapEx 2020 high-voltage power line. Because we were hesitant to sign the proposed easement agreement for 7.5 acres of our property along I-94 has been condemned and used as the CapEx wished. The easement that CapEx insisted on for their project has destroyed a portion of our property forever and gives CapEx the right to drive through our farmyard wherever they choose. Where once had almost a mile-long row of trees that had been planted 20 years ago and nurtured into a beautiful border along the freeway, we now have four unsightly 150-foot towers, with the high voltage power line. Our fences have been moved, and our property cannot be irrigated, built under, or replant trees in the easement area. Our personal use of our own land is restricted by the CapEx easement conditions, and we must put up with trucks and equipment driving through our yard, which we felt has a serious invasion of our privacy and safety concerns for our grandchildren and animals. Also, we are not convinced that
There is not a health risk to people who reside close to such voltage lines. Because of these concerns, although we had no prior intention of moving from our beautiful farm where we had hoped to live for the rest of our lives, Linda and I have elected to exercise our statutory right to have the power companies purchase our entire farm. We just could not bear the intrusion through our farmyard and the destruction of our property CapEx demanded with their easement conditions. Since CapEx condemned our property, we have experienced endless delays, uncertainty, stalling tactics from CapEx. While we have allowed them access through our farm and a homestead according to their condemnation requirements, they have delayed and strung us along. They have accused us of being unreasonable, questioned our intentions, required us inspections, driven up our attorney's costs, and even doubted the commercial viability and value of our property. They have moved their project through our property, and their high voltage lines are up and running, while our lives have been in limbo for more than 2.5 years. The delays and tactics by CapEx in dealing with landowners is disrespectful and indicates a high disregard for people who have been deeply affected by the erection of their high voltage power lines. Landowners have needed to employ lawyers to safeguard their rights and live with immense uncertainty and insecurity. Their lives have been disrupted. Linda and I did not plan for anything of this magnitude when planning for our retirement, and never dreamed that our personal retirement funds would be depleted by the needs of relocation to another farm because of a large business invading and damaging our land. Because of our experience, we support the proposed legislation that would give us some certainty to landowners affected by large utility projects to clarify what we believe the Buy the Farm law originally was intended. To give owners of property in the path of high voltage power lines the option to have the entire property purchased at a fair price and in a timely manner so that the owners can relocate. We ask that you make it clear that when people like us face this type of involuntary condemnation, we are eligible for relocation and condemnation benefits according to Minnesota laws. CapEx has stated that higher costs to them will result in higher costs to their consumers and customers. Landowners are also consumers and should not have to bear the high financial and personal burden without just compensation for their losses, including relocation benefits. We only wish to be compensated fairly and in a timely manner and hope to make this process a little less agonizing for landowners further up the line. Landowners, homeowners, and farmers need your help to change the legislation so that we can be fairly compensated and not taken advantage of by a big business like CapEx. The cost to purchase a new property and move to a resident and farming operation is great and personal and financial burden, and we believe these power companies should pay the cost under the law, just like any public agency does. This cannot be accomplished without your help. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Next witness, Tom Peterson, Farmers Union.
And while he's coming up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Senator.
Just to talk about the bill very quickly, Section 1 repeals a limit on the appraisal fees, as you can see there. Then what this would then move over to general limits on appraisal fees, which actually would then change back to $1,500 for single and double family, $5,000 for all other types of property. And then Section 2 amends the Buy the Farm law, which removes the requirement that land elected to be taken must be commercially viable, which my last testifier talked about. And it also provides that the rights and protections provided to any owner under the general eminent domain law, including the laws related to a minimum compensation and relocation assistance, apply to an acquisition of land under the section of law containing the Buy the Farm election. The utility is required to make an offer for the elected land within 90 days of the election, which gets to our other concerns by some of the other testifiers, and the section is effective the day following final enactment. So just wanted to kind of clarify parts of the bill itself. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. be very brief. We strongly support Senate File 183. We worked for many years supporting eminent domain type bills. Worked with Senator Dahl when before on his legislation that addressed a lot of these concerns. We think that this provision, the Buy the Farm, those provisions that we changed several years ago should apply to Buy the Farm. And we worked with our members in Scott and Stearns. Pope, Sibley counties are where I hear a lot of these information. We're looking for fair and just treatment in a timely manner for our members to address the relocation, the appraisals, attorney fees, and also the commercially viable provision. And feel this legislation does it, and urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And I believe there's some representative of CapEx who's here to testify as well. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and begin.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Dan Lesher, and I am work for CapEx 2020 on the Brookings Project. I am the routes and land rights lead for that project. Thank you very much for your time to discuss Senate File 183 with you tonight. Reliable and affordable electricity is the fuel that drives economic developments and job creation. The three CapEx 2020 projects now under construction will ensure Minnesota customers, including farms, businesses, hospitals, and factories, continue to have the reliable electricity they require. Furthermore, the CapEx 2020 lines are needed to integrate the necessary alternative energy required for the utilities to meet the 25% Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard, which is 30% for Xcel Energy, one of the most aggressive renewable energy mandates in the country. Wind farms that provide CapEx 2020 utilities with the electricity are mainly located in the far-reaching parts of the state where high-voltage transmission lines were never built and never needed. Routing transmission lines is a difficult process. The idea of having a 150-foot steel pole on your property is something for a property owner that is very hard to come to terms with, and we certainly understand that. We have spent more than 6 years working through a very public regulatory process. We have hosted and participated in hundreds of public meetings and presentations. We sent out more than 1 million direct mail pieces. In the end, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission approved approximately 650 miles of new transmission lines under the CapEx projects. In acquiring the easements needed to build the lines, we have worked hard to provide landowners fair and timely compensation. As part of the easement acquisition process, Minnesota has a one-of-a-kind statute, Buy the Farm. Only electric utilities in Minnesota are subject to this statute. In fact, no other condemning authorities, not MnDOT or local governments, are required to purchase more property than the area required to build the infrastructure project. For those landowners who have elected Buy the Farm, we have accepted those elections that meet the intent of the statute. But the election also needs to meet conditions set forth by the Minnesota Supreme Court to survive a judicial review, that the election be reasonable and that the property be commercially viable. In the cases of Ms. Schwartz and the dairy farm and Mr. Lindberg, both of those elections were reviewed by our companies and deemed as making the conditions of the statute. We felt that they deserved to have fair compensation for the entire property, and in both cases we agreed with their election for Buy the Farm. And in some cases, it has taken some time due to the eminent domain process, and we continue to work through those. But an example I'd like to share with you would be is if we had a transmission line that touched a piece of property, a 10-acre parcel of property, and in that particular case, the easement area would be, let's say, an acre. And it's important to note that in agricultural areas and in all cases, the landowner is free to use that easement for whatever purposes they used before. The only things we limit are trees and structures just for the safety of the transmission line itself. But let's say on the 10-acre parcel that has the easement sitting on it, the property owner decides to elect another four parcels of his property, totaling more than 130 acres of property. I would ask whether that is reasonable for us to be able to purchase that entire property if the transmission line is only touching the 10-acre parcel. So these are the things that we are faced when we are looking at elections, and we have to review each of these elections on its own merit, because every property and every election is very unique, and we take that very seriously. The question is to whether an owner can make a claim for something beyond the fair market value of the elected property in terms of relocation expenses and minimum or extra compensation will be heard by the Minnesota Supreme Court on April 3rd. A decision is expected sometime this summer. We would ask the committee to wait for the court's decision, as it would provide guidance for conditions that the legislature may impose on the condemning authority. We understand that some landowners have been very frustrated with the lengthy process of buy the farm. The buy the farm statute, as I mentioned before, is an eminent domain. It follows the eminent domain process. The eminent domain process is lengthy and complex on landowners, and we understand that. CAPEX 2020 has made many attempts to meet with opposing counsel, and in those meetings we have had very good conversations about trying to streamline the process and move forward with the elections that we are faced with. And we continue to make those efforts and strive to come to agreement on streamlining the process. The CAPEX 2020 projects, like any other utility infrastructure upgrade, are paid for by our customers. We are working hard to manage the overall cost of the project while paying landowners fair compensation based on current market conditions. We look forward to working with the legislature to achieve this goal. I'd like to mention that with me today is Steve Quam. He is our lead counsel for land rights issues on CAPEX, and I'm certainly available for questions, and so is Steve Quam. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lester. Questions from the committee. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious regarding the CAPEX 2020, and you mentioned the renewable energy standard, which you said was the toughest in the country, or some words to that effect. Are you telling us that then all of this power that would go through that line is staying within Minnesota, within the area?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the idea of the CAPEX transmission lines, and specifically on the Brookings project, which is the project that I work on, one of the main goals is to provide generation outlet. As we know, a lot of the wind development is coming from the Buffalo Ridge in South Dakota and on the far reaches of Minnesota. But there's lots of other areas of Minnesota that there is renewable energy being developed, and specifically wind energy. But the problem is that there's no transmission to bring that electricity to market. The idea of certainly the Brookings project and other part of the other CAPEX projects is to deliver that electricity and provide increased reliability to the state of Minnesota. There is one of the projects goes from Hampton to Rochester and then to La Crosse, but historically, as far as I'm aware, Minnesota has been an importing state of electricity, and so this is the reason behind some of these lines is not only for increased reliability, but for increase in renewable energy.
Mr. Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think you answered the question. And I understand it's going to go to La Crosse, so we're kind of going through. My question specifically was, is all this energy that you're putting in this line going to stay within Minnesota? And you've mentioned La Crosse. But is the rest of it going to stay within Minnesota to meet our renewable energy standard?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can answer that question. I'm not familiar enough with that side of the generation and exactly how that ends up working. I'm sorry.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I obviously understand contiguous land and that type of thing, but can you explain briefly for me what goes into the determination of commercially viable?
Mr. Quam.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Quam, and I am Land Rights Counsel for the CAPEX project. I believe Senator Weber's question is what does it mean to be commercially viable? Mm-hmm. As you have reviewed the existing statute under Section 216, 12, Subdivision 4, there's no definition provided within the statute. Further, in the 1980 case of Cooperative Power Association versus Assand, although they recognize commercial viability as critical to the statute surviving review, they provide no guidance regarding what it means for a property to be commercially viable. From a common sense perspective, a property that is being put to a utility is a property that should be able to be sold on the open market.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, and I believe that's part of the problem here is that what is defined as commercially viable, I believe, is disagreed upon by the people from CAPEX and the attorneys that are representing the landowners. And because maybe a well problem that could cost maybe $20,000 to get fixed, the entire property then might be deemed as not commercially viable. So there's a number of it seems, that are hurdles or excuses that are being made, and we want to just clarify that. And again, you know, one other aside is I'm not opposed to transmission. Many people, even that I'm carrying this bill for, are. But this is really about the landowners and how they're being treated by the condemnation proceedings under eminent domain. This isn't about needing energy or electricity. This is about treatment of landowners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then is it possible that land could be by the farm could be implemented on land that is not contiguous to the easement land?
Is the question directed to me, Senator Weber, Mr.
Well,
Chair?
To whomever may answer, who can answer it. I'm fine with whoever.
The existing statute discusses commercially viable contiguous property. The Assand case references property contiguous to the easement that is necessary for the project. Could a farm with 440s and an additional 240s that are a half mile away, I have to do the math now, elect the whole 240? I don't believe so.
Senator, we've seen numerous challenges based on objections to elections. In the case of Brad Lindbergh, we went through 2 years of objections because his septic system, although fully operational, wasn't up to code. Any of you folks know that you can have a septic system that might be 10 or 15 years old that might not meet current code requirements. And it's as if Senator Tory Westrum said in one time, we're getting to the ridiculousness on some of these challenges that we're going to have loose doorknobs in some of these cases. It's been a tough arrangement. I haven't seen any cases where we've had parcels that have been far removed, but we have some situations, as you all you folks know that are from any place that understands what a 40 is. You have farmers who tend to buy a 40 here and an 80 there and a 60 and a piece here and there, and they're contiguous. And in some of the cases, there's been challenges to those as to whether or not, you know, they're appropriate because it's a reasonable election. We don't know why some of the objections are made. In one case, we're finding that they are in some cases actually not fighting them on the objections. But they're saying, we're not currently objecting, but we don't waive any of our rights to object at any time in the future. When the testimony was that Brad Lindbergh and Julie Schwartz properties had been accepted. They both told me that that's news to them. They're on a waiting list, and they haven't been fully informed that there's any objection that it's been waived either. You can't kind of say, we're not going to object to this, you know, at this time, but we can object any time that we want to, and we retain that right to do it. And that's one of the problems and one of the delays and one of the quandaries that many of these landowners put themselves into. When you go through years of delays, just the delays and the psychological strain is a tremendous hardship, and that's one of the things that we're trying to avoid. Thank you.
Sam Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Might I ask, Ms. Schwartz made the comment about a date in 2012 being the valuation date, and is value determined as of the date that the request is made as far as to buy the farm? Is that the valuation date at that point?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that question directed to me?
Yes, please.
Mr. Snicker?
Or either if you have different opinions, I'd be glad to hear both of them.
We'll both probably give the same answer to that
okay,
one.
Okay, very good.
Well, in a typical condemnation case, the date of value is the date that title and possession passes to the property being acquired from the owner to the taking authority. Okay. What makes it difficult in a buy-the-farm situation is for a transmission easement, typically the quick take process of 117042 is used, so you have a defined date. The buy-the-farm statute itself does not indicate that title and possession passes pursuant to the quick-take process. So there's a question as to when title and possession actually passes. So then there's a question regarding what is the date of value. Does that make sense?
I understand.
Yes.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
So is there – and, of course, we are – this past year, well, past couple of years, in the rural agricultural property values have seen some certain substantial increases. Is there any provision within the current statute that allows the property owners to be paid on the basis of current values? Certainly, I don't think the intent of the law was for the utility companies to acquire the property and then make a capital gain on the basis of being able to resell the property. So is there anything that is in that could be worked out in that respect? And also, I would like to ask on combination with that, typically properties that are under threat of condemnation, there are special tax provisions that are allowed to property owners, and does buy the farm legislation qualify those people for that type of special tax treatment? In other words, not having to claim the profits if property is reinvested or from money is reinvested in similar property, et cetera.
Senator Weber, as to the tax provisions, it's my understanding that they would be afforded the same right. That issue hasn't been litigated. Presumably, at the rate we're going, it probably will be. But as to the cost, and that is a significant issue for some of these property owners, because one of the issues is, and the biggest issue, the quandary that they have is they elect, and even if their election, even if they do have the process to determine the fair market value of their property and they get an award in the condemnation process, they still need to be afforded the relocation benefits. And to move a farm operation can be very expensive, especially when you're talking about a dairy farm, for example. But one of the other issues that was addressed in some of the litigation was minimum compensation. And minimum compensation, which this legislature passed in 2006, does have a balancing kind of a mechanism in it to turn around and address some of those increased costs for an actual relocation, for when a business, a farm operation, would actually buy a replacement property. What it costs you might be a factor that might be considered. And I think that that's probably the evening force in that regard. And we're seeing the very issue that you're addressing in some of the other matters that we have. I have some condemnations right now that started in 2010, 2009. They haven't been litigated yet. And we know properties values have gone up since then.
Further questions?
The other side would like to respond.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee and Senator Weber, may May I put a little context to Mr. Schnitker's answer, if that would be okay? As to your question, Senator Weber, do you think we could work with the author and the owner's counsel to figure out a date of value that makes sense for both sides? Sure. We've worked with owner's counsel for years. We continue to work with them. I exchanged emails today with Mr. Schnitker's colleague, Mr. Crass, on process that can be improved to streamline this for both sides. We can do that. I think we can provide you with language that will help. As to the tax question, I'm not a tax lawyer, but there's not going to be litigation from the condemning authority side regarding how an owner treats that property. Regarding litigation and delay and the litigious nature with respect to the Lindbergh parcel, I don't want this to be a debate about what's happened with the Lindberghs. I will say only that the Lindbergh's election was accepted. There was a hearing on the fair market value of that property. The hearing was scheduled after the Lindberghs were able to get an appraisal. We waited for the Lindberghs to get an appraiser, and it was scheduled in connection with their counsel. That's how legal process works, and that's how it worked in that case.
Further discussion? I'm told that Craig Johnson from the League of Cities wanted to speak briefly to the bill.
Mr. Chair? Right here.
Oh, Senator Dahl, I'm sorry I didn't see you here.
Mr. Chair, and I know Mr. Johnson has talked to me, and I know he has concerns about bringing in the smaller municipal utilities into this. It was my understanding that there had been an amendment in the House that eliminated some of his concerns, but we're not sure about that. But I certainly, as I did with the eminent domain laws that we passed in 2010, I worked with them then, and I do intend to work with him now as if this bill moves forward. But I certainly will allow him a chance to express that himself.
Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I do appreciate Senator Dahl worked with us very closely in 2009 and 2010 to address concerns with proposals that were being developed then. Section 1 of this bill, just to be clear, members, is not by the farm. This is an actual change to all eminent domain proceedings of any sort that affect any public service corporation. It's not only for high-voltage transmission lines. It's not only for electric utilities. Members, the definition of public service corporations is very expansive. It includes cooperative associations, natural gas pipelines, gas, electric, telephone, cable, crude oil, municipal utility, water, stormwater, wastewater, watershed districts, drainage authorities, municipal airports, and a number of other entities. This would actually change the appraisal fee collected during any process using eminent domain or easement from $1,500 to $1,500 or $5,000, depending on the type of property. $1,500 for single family and two family residents, $5,000 for everything else that an easement is going across. The history, members, on this is that in 2006, eminent domain law was pretty significantly changed in Minnesota. It was rewritten to significantly scale down government authority to do takings of private property and to significantly change the process used to determine the values and costs of that to be more in the favor of the property owner and less in the favor of the government. That was a very contentious debate. A lot of things were done. One of the things that was included in that is the language that you see part of which is being deleted in Section 1, which said this isn't really about public service corporations as much as it's about other types of uses. When we're talking about a city putting in a utility to provide water or sewer or stormwater or other services of that sort, that's pretty clearly a public benefit. We're not doing economic development at the expense of one property owner in favor of another. So we're going to let them continue to use, it does not say they don't have to go through the eminent domain proceedings. It says they continue to use the previous process that we had in the state. The new process was applied to all of the other types of use of eminent domain. In 2010, when we worked with Senator Dahl on the fix to this, we expanded that the high-voltage transmission line and pipeline sightings would also be affected by the 2006 changes. So they were rolled in as something that needed to do the more thorough process for environmental review. Eminent domain review. And that was the change we worked out at that time. What the first section of this bill currently does is removes the limit on appraisal fee awards for all public service corporations. So it's not part of By the Farm, and it actually expands to include many city, county, and town utility services that would have a definite impact on this that would have to be passed on to local ratepayers and businesses. So, Mr. Chair, respectfully, while I'm happy to continue to work with the senator on this, this is a very significant provision for local governments and for the utilities that we're required to operate for the health and safety of our citizens.
Senator Dell.
Chairman Marty, my name is John Morphew. I'm one of the attorneys working with Kirk Schnicker, representing some of the landowners impacted by the farm and CapEx. The intent of this change was to clear up a perceived conflict between some language within the proposed statute or the amendments and the appraisal language contained within Chapter 117. And the way I read it, this, by deleting the lines in 1.16 through 1.19, would mean that the normal appraisal rights, the fees or reimbursement amounts that are allowed under Chapter 117 would apply. And it is to public service corporations, as Mr. Johnson says, but it's only in the construction or the expansion of high-voltage transmission lines of 100 kilovolts or more, or natural gas, petroleum products, pipelines, or ancillary compressor stations or pumping stations. Unless I...
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that that's the intent, but what the language that is being deleted says is for purposes of an award of appraisal fees under 117.085, the fees awarded may not exceed $1,500 for all types of property, and et cetera, and then says 3,000 max for a high-voltage transmission line. If you go to the reference section of statute, it actually, the rest of eminent domain law applies now because this exception is being removed, and the standard appraisal rate for all other types of eminent domain proceedings that are not exempted under this is $1,500 for a single or dual family, $5,000 for all other types of property for the appraisal fee that they can claim. So that may not have been the intent, but it does apply to all easements or takings done by any public utility, including water, sewer, and drainage.
Mr. Chair, and again, we have a little disagreement on what that actually applies to. And again, we did make a fix last time, and I want to make that same fix, but I want to get it right. So I'm willing to work with this segment of as we hopefully can move forward.
So you're not disagreeing with him. You're disagreeing with what the intent. Your intent would address his concern, but he's saying that your language does not, and you're disagreeing with that.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I, you thought it was amended in the House, but we disagree on whether that amendment was carried in the House, and that might have been helpful. But again, I know on the fly here, I don't want to make amendments without making sure that we are addressing the concerns of the Schwartzes and the Lindbergs. I certainly also, and I have a track record of working with Craig on this issue, and I intend to fix it this time as well.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Perhaps counsel can give their opinion on the language reads and the interpretation.
All right,
Mr.
Ford. My impression is Mr. Johnson's analysis is correct.
If you wanted your word for that, yeah.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
He was saying that he thinks Mr. Johnson's analysis is correct.
Mr. Chair, if it's going to get this bill passed, we'll offer an amendment to remove Section 1 of the bill.
To Senator
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Is that the amendment that was in the House? Is that sync the bill up with the House?
So you want to delete Section 1. That's the amendment. Senator Rosen, did you propose that?
Yes.
Senator Rosen moves to delete Section 1. Further discussion on that amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, just so it's on the record, Representative Bly told me that's the amendment he was making. He made the amendment before I got in the room, but everyone else in the room has told me that he made that amendment. And he actually talked to me today and said that that's what he did. So I'm basing it off of that, and he did plan on removing Section 1, which is what I had communicated to Senator Dahl this morning.
So Senator Rosen moves to delete Section 1. Is there further discussion?
So, Mr. Chair, what does that do? I mean, Senator Dahl, what does this do then?
Removes the municipal utilities from being subject to the same kind of rules.
It keeps them at the 1,500 and 3,000 limits.
Just leaves that in place.
Mr. Chair and members, it would leave high voltage lines at the 3,000 limit per property and all other public service corporations at 1,500.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dare I ask, how much does an appraisal cost?
Chairman Marty, for these types of projects, it's significantly more than even $5,000 for most of these appraisals. You're probably well in excess of $5,000, but the $5,000 does help in terms of going towards it, but the $2,000 probably doesn't really matter all that much considering how much some of these appraisals and minimum compensation studies do cost.
Further discussion on the motion to delete Section 1. If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. On the bill.
So moved.
Sarah. The council says we need there's a technical amendment on page 2, line 25. Delete this and insert after chapter 117. Senator Hoffman moves that technical amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, I move this bill.
Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 183 as amended. He recommended to pass, and that goes to Judiciary. Further discussion. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I sympathize with the people that have been here today. My concern is that as it relates to I don't really see how this bill addresses the issue as far as compensation as opposed to a tooth I date in 2012 as to now. I think there's maybe other things that need to be clarified in my opinion. I guess I'd rather see more clarification of some of those items, and I know that things can be added as it goes on. I'm new to this process, but sometimes when you only have one chance to do it, I guess I want to make that statement that I think there are certain issues that are not addressed here, and for that reason I'll probably vote no, but I certainly understand some of the issues that are there, and I think there's maybe other things that need to be done.
Further discussion. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand there's a court case going on related to this. Perhaps some of the more senior members or the two attorneys could advise this committee before we vote what impact this moving legislation have on court deliberations, if the attorneys are comfortable addressing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the issue before the Supreme Court that is going to be heard on April 3rd is whether an owner who makes a buy the farm election or who chooses to make an election is an owner who must relocate for the purposes of Section 117-187, which is known as the minimum compensation statute. The second question before the Supreme Court is an owner who chooses to make that election someone who is required to move as a result of the project for the purposes of the relocation statute and scheme. The Court of Appeals concluded that a person who chooses to make an election isn't someone who must relocate, and so that they cannot make a claim for minimum compensation. The court's going to hear oral argument on that case on April 3rd. How your decision affects their deliberations, I can only speculate. I will say that the relationship between this statute, is unique, right? It is definitely unique, and the Supreme Court has recognized it. Senate counsel's probably reviewed both the Assange and the Williams cases, and he could probably provide context not from an advocate but from your counsel. The only thing I can add as you consider this is there's a request from the owners to be treated as if this property were condemned by any other agency. The property that's needed here typically is a strip. And if MnDOT condemns that strip, the taking isn't expanded by the landowner. The decision as to how much is taken stays with the taking authority. So if MnDOT condemns the Lindbergh parcel or some other hypothetical parcel, they're entitled to just compensation, which is defined as the difference between the before value of their property and the after value of their property. They're not entitled to expand the taking. Here, they have more rights than if the property were condemned by MnDOT, a pipeline company, or by any other taking authority in Minnesota.
And in answer to your question, it would only be speculation as to figure out how that would apply to their deliberations. I doubt that it would have much of any impact upon it, frankly.
Senator Dahl.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, you know, as I read the exciting language in the court decisions at several levels, several times. I'll give you one example from a dissenting judge in an appellate court. If the legislature intended to side with utilities over these effectively dispossessed landowners to such an extent, it would have provided with specific language excluding landowners who elect to transfer a fee interest in their property from receiving minimum compensation and relocation benefits. The legislature did not do so. My only point there is we need definitions. Regardless of what the court decides, we need clarification on this issue to avoid further and further litigation. They may answer a question for us, but we want to be quite clear on what that should be.
As I think the only member of this committee who served with Senator Merriam, I think his letter is saying that's what he intended. I wasn't here when he passed this law, but he's saying that's what they intended. Further discussion on the Hoffman motion. This bill is going to judiciary. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Chair and members.
One more bill, and then we will. Chair.
I know. I've got one copy. That's the question. I have two copies.
Did you see my response?
Just going to leave this other one for a
That's what it looks like, judiciary. Then nobody tells me.
I respect you.
Oh, that's why. I was going to say. That's
all right.
Okay.
Senator Metzen would say that. Saddle up.
Here we are.
Senator Marty, as the room clears out, we'll get going.
Bye bye now. You're dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a good short bill.
Nice.
They like short.
You're an optimist.
I didn't say short in length of time to discuss it. It's short in terms of number of words. Senate File 1166 would ban the use of sale of products for personal care products, cosmetics, cleaning products, including that contain triclosan, triclocarbon, or similar antibacterial compounds. And we have an exemption for products used solely in medical facilities. And I'm going to spend I'm going to not talk much about the bill right now because several people to testify on it. I will say that we had some studies, some of them funded by LCMR, that talked about the impact of triclosan as it breaks down in our lakes and rivers. And I'm going to have Bill Arnold and Dan Engstrom from University of Minnesota present first. I'm happy to stand for questions at any time, but I think we might as well have the witnesses. I have three or four here, and then there are three or four on the other side as well.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Is Bill Arnold or Dan Engstrom coming up? Bill Arnold, welcome. Please state your name and where you're from for record, and welcome to the committee.
I'm Bill Arnold. I'm a professor of civil engineering at the University of Minnesota.
And I'm Dan Engstrom. I direct the St. Croix Watershed Research Station for the Science Museum in Minnesota, and I'm also an adjunct professor of earth sciences at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome, Bill and Dan. Who's going to start? Who's going to go first?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Arnold.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us. I was the lead investigator on the LCCMR proposal that Senator Marty referenced. And our focus was on what happened to triclosan once it got out into the environment after it was used in its consumer products or other soaps, lotions, whatever products that go down the drain to the wastewater treatment plant. So the first piece of our work was to look at what happens in the wastewater treatment process. And the important thing to remember is that wastewater treatment was not designed to remove trace chemicals like this. So any removal is kind of a lucky accident in some ways. And it turns out for triclosan, 90 to 95% of it is removed from the influent of the plant to the effluent of the plant. The removal happens by a combination of biodegradation and then sorption to the solids, or the biosolids that are produced in the plant. And I'll come back to that issue at the end. One thing we do in Minnesota is for parts of the year is we disinfect our wastewater with chlorine. And when the fraction of triclosan that's leaving in the effluent gets hit with the chlorine, we create three new compounds, which we call chlorinated triclosan derivatives. So that the triclosan molecule with one or two chlorine atoms added to it. So the triclosan and these derivatives are then discharged into the environment. And whereas triclosan is a well-studied molecule used in many products, these chlorinated triclosan derivatives, it's really unknown what their biological effects are. So the concentrations we found at the Metro plant in St. Paul were about 100 to 200 nanograms per liter of triclosan, about 30 nanograms per liter of these triclosan derivatives. And then the USGS has done some studies in Minnesota that shows that triclosan levels are in the range of 50 to 100 nanograms per liter in rivers. While these levels are small, they are in the range that some studies have shown can affect algal communities or change their function and structure. And algae are, of course, the bottom of the food chain in lakes and rivers, so that's a potential adverse effect. So once released, the triclosan in these three derivatives are exposed to sunlight, and that was a major focus of our research to see what these products were. And these four compounds form four specific dioxins when they're exposed to sunlight. Now, there are 209 total different dioxins, but there are four that only come from triclosan. So we can track those four specific dioxins in the environment. Now, in the past, the major source of dioxins to the environment was incineration processes and poorly functioned incinerators, backyard trash burning, and the like. So by taking sediment cores from eight lakes in Minnesota, we were able to look at the historical trends of triclosan, chlorinated triclosan derivatives, and these four specific dioxins. And what we found is that concentrations are generally increasing with time, corresponding to increased consumer use of triclosan. And it's clear from these results that the chlorinated triclosan derivatives and these four dioxins are derived from triclosan because they follow very similar trends in the sediment cores. So what concentrations do we see in Lake Tepin, which watershed covers about half the state, so it's got many different wastewater sources but also lots of dilution. We see about 10 nanograms of triclosan per gram of sediment. In a smaller lake, Lake Winona near Alexandria, where about two-thirds of the influent of that lake is treated wastewater from the Alexandria wastewater treatment plant, we see concentrations of about 150 nanograms per gram in the sediment. And we also see these chlorinated triclosan derivatives and then the four dioxins that are derived from triclosan as well. Now, as a control, we looked at Little Lake Wilson in Superior Forest. There's no wastewater influent into Little Lake Wilson, and there's no triclosan in Little Lake Wilson. So that means these compounds are coming from triclosan. So, again, these concentrations in the sediments, nanograms are small numbers, but nanograms can be important. There are the processes of bioaccumulation. So, for example, algae can take up triclosanate levels 1,000 times that in water. And organisms living in the sediment can also take up the triclosan, and then there's a potential for it to move up the food chain. So I want to come back to the dioxins. In the 70s, we realized dioxins were a problem, and they were coming from incinerators, and we changed our incineration practices. And so dioxins with four or more chlorines generally come from incinerators, and the levels of those dioxins have been decreasing since the 1970s. The four dioxins derived from triclosan, however, have been increasing since the 1970s. So in Lake Pepin, now about one-third of the total dioxin mass to the loading to the lake is from triclosan-derived dioxins. And in Lake Winona, it's about 60% of the dioxin loading is from triclosan-derived dioxins. Now, an important point to make with dioxins is because there are 209 of them, there's a broad range of toxicity in dioxins. And the four dioxins that come from triclosan are not particularly well studied because everything was done on dioxins with more chlorines that come from incineration. So some of the data on toxicity is 30 years old. Of the recent data that's out there, there's one study that suggests that these dioxins from triclosan are at least 1,000 times less toxic than the most toxic dioxin congener. But in our studies, we see much more of the triclosan-derived dioxins than we see of the most toxic dioxin congener, so there's a trade-off there. Lastly, I wanted to come back to the biosolids. So a large portion of the triclosan that's removed during wastewater treatment goes into biosolids. About a third of biosolids in the metro area are deposited on land, so that's a way that triclosan could get reintroduced into the environment after it's removed from during wastewater treatment. And also, Professor Rolf Halden's Arizona State did a large study looking at biosolids around the country and found that if you take the total mass of pharmaceuticals that's present in biosolids, two-thirds of that mass can be attributed to triclosan and triclocarban. So lastly, if the legislature decides this is a problem they want to solve, there are different routes to do it. One is this bill to control use in some way. We could also, of course, engineer a solution to remove it from wastewater treatment plants. The latter is going to be a large, expensive endeavor. And with that, we can take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Senator Marty, do you want to take questions now, or should we go to Mr. Engstrom?
If there are questions, yeah, or Mr. Engstrom, did you want to add anything?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here primarily to help Dr. Arnold answer questions, so I think he's covered the ground pretty well.
Awesome. Members, any questions for Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some clarification. I was trying to read through a few things while you were speaking, and I don't know if I covered everything as well as possible, but it mentions, it talks about phasing this out effective January 1st, 2014, but medical use of this is not covered by this bill. And what would be a medical use of this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, member of the committee.
Mr. Arnold.
I would assume that would be hospitals, medical clinics, and the like, but I'm not an expert on that particular use. I would refer that question to Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, the point being the concern here is, our Minnesota Department of Health has found no benefit to use of it in households. They recommend against, as does AMA and others. And there is concern about many things besides just the environmental use of it and so on. In hospitals and healthcare facilities, there is, it is an antibacterial, and in some cases it may help. I know Kaiser Healthcare System is, at least for their hand washing things and so on, they are phasing it out. In other words, some medical facilities may be phasing it out. I don't know the details of how much it's being phased out and so on. But in terms of when there's something that is causing some risk, there is question. I think there's a lot of questions about the risk to humans. 75% of us, I think there's a handout, talks about 3/4 of people have it in their bloodstream. I believe it's an endocrine-disrupting type of chemical. I think it's got some risk about possible antibiotic resistance. I'm not the scientist, and I don't want to pretend to be that, but I will say that when the state health department, the MMA, AMA at least, are saying let's not be using it for, it doesn't have a benefit to it, let's phase it out. And the governor did issue an executive order recently that bans, that phases out the state purchases of it as well.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Follow-up, Senator Weber?
No, thank you.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Marty. Through all of the information I was looking through, as well as Senator Weber was, I'm looking for references to what the FDA and EPA have to say, and none of the handouts or none of the testimony from what I heard addresses anything what the FDA might have to say. Do you have any information on that?
Mr. Arnold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, members of the committee, the current FDA reports, if you look at the website, say they find no benefit over regular hand washing with regular soap and water. So they regulate it for household use. The EPA, I believe, regulates it as a pesticide use and has said it's safe for those uses. But both the FDA and the EPA, I believe, are currently reevaluating triclosan.
Senator Osmick, follow-up? Nope.
No.
Mr. Arnold, that's a great segue. If there are no other questions for Mr. Arnold or Mr. Engstrom, then Kathy Moger from Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Trevor Russell, Friends of Mississippi, are here as well. So thank you. And did I pronounce your last name right?
You did. Thank you, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Ms. Moger, welcome, and please state your name and the agency you're with, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Kathy Moger. I'm the Sustainability Manager for the Pollution Control Agency, and as that, I help coordinate the responses for state agencies under the Governor's Executive Order 11-13, which is related to state agency sustainability. The Pollution Control Agency actually started working with Department of Administration 5 years ago on a cleaning products contract that had a preference for products that did not contain any antimicrobial claims, and so they would be triclosan-free. There's about 100 products on that contract right now that meet that preference. The Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team, which is created in the governor's executive order, has been in existence since 1992. It's actually been in multiple governor's executive orders, and the Pollution Control Agency has always served as chair of the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team, which I'm going to call IPAT from now on because it's a mouthful to say IPAT. Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team.
Another acronym,
I'm sorry. So last year, IPAT started working on new targets for the model sustainability plans under Executive Order 11-13, particularly in the area of toxics reduction. On February 28th of this year, IPAT adopted a target for eliminating purchases of hand soaps, dishwashing, and laundry products that contain triclosan. So in addition to the contract that I just described for you for cleaning products, Department of Administration has issued a request for proposals for dishwashing and laundry products that are triclosan-free. They expect to have that contract existence by March 31st of this year.
Senator Osmick.
I'm sorry, I'll let her finish her testimony,
okay.
And I'd like to question her after that.
Thank you, Senator Osmick. I duly noted. Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Moger.
Okay, so all agencies under this new executive order target would be required to have strategies that eliminate the purchase of these products in their annual sustainability plans, which are due June 30th of this year. However, under Executive Order 11-13, the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency also has the ability to waive the target or the timelines for good cause. And in this case, we expected that might include medical or food safety needs, and we've indicated that to the IPAT members that we would As we were developing information for them about the changes in the annual sustainability plan, that we would also provide them information regarding the waiver process that they might use. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Ms. Moger, thank you. Start with Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. A question. We hear a lot of information about it might cause this, it might cause that. There's a lot of conjecture, not necessarily supported by the EPA or the FDA. Is there any information that actually shows us the other side by removing it? What are the health risks that society or Minnesota will be impacted by not having it in there? Is there increased risk for people that are prone to bacterial infections? Are there different types of illnesses that may increase as a result of removing this from the supply?
Ms. Moger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmak, I'm not from the Department of Health, so I can't, and again, I'm not a scientist, similar to what Senator Marty said. I'm a planner by trade, but my understanding is that the Federal Food and Drug Administration has indicated that hand washing with vigorous movement and use of paper towels or cloth towels will remove the bacteria in question. And so there is extreme comfort in removing that from hand soaps. There may be a need for hand soaps containing that product in medical or food safety areas, which is why we tried to err on the side of caution and allow that as a waiver. For dishwashing and laundry settings, we did not find any information that said that it was necessary.
Thank you, Senator Osmak. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't see in this legislation where it exempts the food safety. Is that included in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we've been having some conversations, including this afternoon with Ecolab, who I think is testifying. Yes, they are testifying. And we are likely to add, I'm not sure exactly what wording we would be doing, but for some commercial food establishments, processing, and so on.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, so about... with the ban of any personal care products, cosmetics, or cleaning products, about how many different products are we talking about here that would no longer be eligible?
Senator Marty.
I might ask my next witness, might be a better person to answer that, but there are quite a few products that did contain them, I think, more and more. I think the Minnesota brand Soft Soap was one of those who used to use it. I do not believe they use it anymore. I couldn't tell you who does and who doesn't, but for our next witness.
Senator Marty, Senator Eaton, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that as a nurse, I've been exposed to this. It's there is also the danger of causing it to be tolerant, of the increased tolerance to the chemicals so that bacteria doesn't get destroyed in the areas where it's needed. It's kind of like what we're doing with the oral antibiotics. You know, if you resistance. Overuse a chemical, it becomes less effective down the road because the bacteria has changed or adapted to it.
Thank you, Senator Eaton. Senator Brown, I didn't mean to stop you, but you wanted to wait till Trevor
yes.
to ask your follow-ups. Thank you. Welcome, Trevor Russell. Please state who you are and where you're from. Welcome to the committee.
All righty. Greetings, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Trevor Russell. I'm the Watershed Program Director with Friends of the Mississippi River. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization based in St. Paul. We exist to protect and preserve and enhance the Mississippi River. I'm here to talk about three issues: environmental toxicity, human health, and product effectiveness with triclosan in consumer products. In terms of environmental toxicity, we know about 58% of streams in the U.S. Tested do contain triclosan, including the Mississippi River. As a registered pesticide, this isn't a good thing because we know triclosan can have an impact on aquatic algae and other microorganisms that are important to overall river health. But the more pressing concern with triclosan is its tendency to convert to dioxins through the wastewater treatment system. Triclosan-derived dioxins have increased by 200 to 300% in Lake Pepin sediment since 1963, while all other dioxins have decreased by 73 to 90% during that same time period. Triclosan-derived dioxins have now been found accumulating in our lakes as well. Dioxins are a class of particularly carcinogenic, bioaccumulating, long-life compounds. Some are pretty well known, so 2378 TCDD, that's sort of the gold standard of triclosan. You may know that from its presence in Agent Orange. Other dioxins have lesser degrees of potency or toxicity, but there's a range or a continuum of toxicity with dioxins. And the truth is, we don't know exactly where all of the triclosan-derived dioxins end up on that range. We do know there's a lot of them, so even less potent triclosan-derived dioxins could still pose, in aggregate, a fairly substantial risk for river health, even if individually they're not as potent. That said, the best dioxin is a bad dioxin. It's a little like you're only drunk driving a little bit. Any dioxin in the environment is a risk to the environment, and it's something we take very seriously. That's why I'm here. For that reason alone, we feel that you should pass this legislation. This is a soap that isn't particularly necessary, and I'll cover that, but it's moving to our environment. It's forming dioxins. Those are building up, and we're really not sure. This could be the next Agent Orange. Or in aggregate, they could be something less than that. But we don't know, and we're asking for you to take preemptive action. So for that reason alone, we ask you to support this legislation. In terms of human health risks, we know humans can be exposed to triclosan through skin contact, ingestion, inhalation, as well as through contaminated drinking water. We have pretty strong evidence to suggest that triclosan exposure can lead to increased allergy susceptibility in children and presents risks for healthy fetal development in pregnant women. Lab research on animals, now again, we don't do lab, you know, experiments on humans for ethical reasons, but we know in labs triclosan can disrupt reproductive, thyroid, central nervous system of species, sometimes at levels found in the environment and in humans. In particular, a recent study by University of California, Davis, looked at triclosan's impact on muscle function and heart function in mice. Researchers found mice showed up to a 25% reduction in heart function measured within 20 minutes of exposure to the chemical. And since there was some debate on this at a previous hearing, I spoke with the authors of that study. They sent me the materials and they highlighted it for me. The 25% reduction in heart function found in mice occurs at concentrations that have been found in the blood of humans who use triclosan products, particularly triclosan mouthwashes, from the authors. So we know there are some substantial health risks associated with the use of this product. We feel that those are secondary to the environmental concerns, but we want you to be aware of those moving forward. In terms of product effectiveness, consumer hand soaps typically have between 0.1 and 0.45% triclosan in them, relatively modest concentrations. There's no evidence that hand washing with triclosan soaps offers any health advantage over regular soap and water. That is the conclusion of the American Medical Association and the Food and Drug Administration. And Allison Aiello, University of Michigan School of Public Health, who researches this topic extensively, said, and I quote, "There's no significant benefit of using triclosan soaps compared with plain soap. And we've seen this both with bacteria on the hands as well as wellness symptoms in the community setting. Soap and water clean your hands just as well as triclosan. And if you're concerned about, just as well as triclosan soaps, if you're concerned about additional bacteria, our good friend alcohol-based sanitizer does not contain triclosan and does remove 99.99% of germs from your hands. So you don't need triclosan soap. There are plenty of alternatives. Triclosan is also used in a couple other things, and I just want to touch on those briefly. It's commonly found in one manufacturer's toothpaste because it kills bacteria that can cause gingivitis, because triclosan kills bacteria. I don't use that toothpaste, and I don't have gingivitis. Many of you don't, and you don't have gingivitis. That's because lots of things can kill bacteria. Antibacterial mouthwashes and antiseptic mouthwashes do the same thing. The assertion that only people that brush teeth with this kind of toothpaste are protected from gingivitis would be somewhat absurd. There are many alternative products. For dish detergents, triclosan can kill bacteria when it's used in your dish detergent, but so can other products that don't have the downstream impacts. On that note, we do want to note that there are a number of consumer organizations that have phased out manufacturers that had phased out the use of this product. Colgate-Palmolive replaced triclosan with lactic acid in its antibacterial dish liquid. And so that's somebody that's already making that move. They've replaced reformulated their soft soap without triclosan. GlaxoSmithKline has removed triclosan from its Aquafresh and Sensodyne toothpaste as well as its Cortisol mouthwash. Johnson & Johnson is phasing out triclosan in all of its products by 2015. So there's already industry movement in this direction. The case for legislation is really this. We know that triclosan prevents a clear environmental risk. For that reason alone, action is warranted. When you add the demonstrated effects on human health, allergies, and fetal health, the case gets pretty strong. Add in the additional human and wildlife health risks that some very compelling research has identified, and this becomes kind of a slam dunk. The test for triclosan isn't whether or not it can kill bacteria. Lots of things kill bacteria. I guess you could brush your teeth with a spent fuel rod if you want to. You'd probably kill bacteria. It doesn't make it a good idea. The test of triclosan is whether or not it exceeds the performance of standard or alternative products by such a wide margin that all of these risks are worth it. And our position simply is they're not. It works for gingivitis, but so does mouthwash. It cleans your hands, but so does soap and water and antibacterials like these. It kills bacteria in your dishes, but so does lactic acid that's already been used. In essence, our medical and health communities recommend against using them. Our brightest research minds are telling us this is building up an environment. Some pretty compelling health research is showing there's some staggering risks associated with this. And plain old common sense would tell us, let's substitute a potentially dangerous product with other products that are proven to work as well and don't have the health risks or environmental risks associated with them. So we'd ask you for your support of this legislation. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. I do have Senator Brown has some follow-up questions, and then Senator Osmick after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Russell, you talked a lot about soap. You did talk about some other things. But about how many products in Minnesota would this affect when we're talking about personal care products, cosmetics, or cleaning products?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding is that about 76% of liquid soaps contain triclosan and about 20% of bar soaps contain those compounds. I'm under the impression that those are somewhat older numbers. When we looked on the Environmental Working Group Skin Deep website, we found a number of producers are starting already to replace these products and replace triclosan in these kinds of products. I wish I had a hard number for you, and I can go back and try to get that for you. But our understanding is that still a significant number of hand soaps in particular still contain triclosan.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Russell. What about for cosmetics and cleaning products? Do you know percentages on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do not. I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Brown.
One final question. I'm serious about this because I just saw it, but the beginning says no person shall offer. Do we classify stores like Target and Mills Fleet Farm and Walmart? Are those persons? Are they affected by this?
Senator Brown, Senator Marty, Mr. Knopf is going to answer that question.
I'd be happy
Chair,
to
I think Senator that. Marty could answer too. Yeah, person is defined in Chapter 645 and includes everything, includes any kind of entity that you can think of.
Or association, yeah.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Senator Brown, follow up at all? Or?
No.
Okay. Senator Osmick and then Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one, I think, goes to Senator Marty. How many other states have this ban in place right now?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, as of today, I think zero. But I will guess that this will happen among a number of states fairly quickly in the next couple years or so.
Oh, thank you, Senator Osmick. Senator Stephen.
Just wanted to clarify with Mr. Russell, I was a little confused. Does triclosan, is that the product that makes it antibacterial? Because when I think back to how I used to buy, or I still buy soft soap, for instance, because it's not antibacterial. That's why I was surprised when you said it contained triclosan. So I'm confused whether that made it antibacterial or not.
Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, Senator, so Colgate-Palmolive makes soft soap brand soap. That's a brand name that used to contain triclosan. They've reformulated that product without triclosan in it.
I know, but is it triclosan
Stephen.
That makes it antibacterial?
Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah. In that product, in its original formulation, triclosan was the antibacterial agent in that product.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stephen. Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, I know there are a couple witnesses from Ecolab and Chamber, and I'm not sure who else.
Sounds like it. We got Jason Greff, Director of Community Relations from Ecolab, Dr. Tim O'Brien from Product Safety and Compliance from Ecolab, and then Tony Quilis from the Chamber. So come on down. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jason Greff. I'm Director of Government Relations with Ecolab, a St. Paul-based company founded here in 1923. We have approximately 3,000 employees here in the state of Minnesota, and we also have a state-of-the-art research and development center located in Eagan as well. As many of you probably know, Ecolab provides a wide variety of cleaning products and services that we provide to the commercial applications in healthcare, food safety, laundry care, ware washing of dishes, food processing, which includes restaurants and food processing facilities throughout the state. The reason we're here is very focused in regards to food safety applications and healthcare applications that utilize triclosan as an antimicrobial agent. From a food safety perspective, we see triclosan as a critical ingredient to prevent foodborne illnesses. So many of the restaurants you eat at, this product will be used in their back-of-the-house operations to make sure that you don't acquire those foodborne illnesses, and also in food processing facilities, it is also used. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to my partner, Dr. Tim O'Brien, who's going to talk about some of the more technical applications, and I think he'll be able to answer a lot of your questions that have come up previously.
Dr. O'Brien, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty and committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today for Ecolab. I am the Global Director of Product Safety and Compliance for Ecolab. I am the corporate toxicologist. My background includes a 13-year career in wastewater treatment, and I've worked with many of the largest wastewater treatment facilities in the country. So I'm very familiar with the issues from an environmental perspective that our colleagues from the University of Minnesota have presented. I have a Ph.D. in toxicology from the University of Minnesota, and my focus is metabolic toxicology. And the purpose, the reason we're here, of course, is this bill and the findings that of the researchers at the University of Minnesota that identified the presence of triclosan in the sediments downstream of wastewater treatment facilities. And it's not surprising, since the wastewater facilities were not designed to remove these types of micro contaminants. And our primary purpose here, though, is that is to address the questions around where is this ingredient needed and when is it necessary. Triclosan, again, is an ingredient, and Ecolab uses it only in one case only. We don't include it in any other ingredients or other formulas other than hand-washing products, hand soaps. And we use those hand soaps in places in hospitals, for example, in critical care environments where there are immune-depressed individuals, or in neonatal environments where newborns or premature babies are potentially exposed to infectious agents. We also sell hand soaps containing triclosan to food manufacturing organizations. So, for example, the large meat and poultry facilities that we have here in the state, or any other food processor. And to speak specifically to these industrial applications, there's an absolute requirement for individuals working in these facilities to wash their hands and have antimicrobial treatment on their hands before they handle food. Now, this can be accomplished in one of two ways. You can wash your hands with a triclosan-based product, so it's a hand soap. You get the cleaning perspective as well as the antimicrobial effect, and you rinse your hands, of course, after you wash, and you go back to your job. And this is required before you even enter the processing floor. Or the other option would be to wash your hands with standard soap and then use an alcohol hand sanitizer, but that is not allowed for food contact in these types of facilities, and you would have to go through a hand rinsing step as well. And so, and not only that, the big food manufacturers do not prefer to have alcohol hand sanitizers in the facility because they're also flammable. Their number one request from us and the number one product for hand washing we sell to them is triclosan-based hand soaps. It protects public health, and there is actually a significant benefit to washing your hands with triclosan-based hand soaps in these situations. The other place that we're here to discuss is also a food a place where food is exposed to potentially dirty hands, and that's in the back of the house for restaurants. Ecolab, again, also the only place we sell this ingredient is in hand soaps, and we sell a majority of our restaurant customers required to an antimicrobial hand cleaner to ensure they can protect their customers from exposure to foodborne illnesses. And I'm certainly open to answering technical questions around the use of triclosan and its effectiveness.
Any questions for our friends from Ecolab? Senator Osma.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I love having a toxicologist here because that's your
that's
branch,
correct.
Right? Because I was thinking about this question and I wanted to confirm it. We heard testimony about a study where the same level of toxic of this chemical was present in human blood that was present in a mouse's blood. And that study indicated that there was heart related illnesses or heart-related damage as a result. Is it fair to compare the two? Because a smaller body will process blood significantly faster or more times through the blood than a human would. Is it fair to compare the two, the human body and the mouse body, at that toxicology level? Or is our toxic level in a mouse's blood far more toxic as a factor of the smallness of the creature?
Dr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmek, I have not read that study, so I have a hard time really discussing the nuances of that study, but I would say this. Now, mouse or rodents are often used as surrogates for humans, but they don't necessarily metabolize chemical substances in the waste the same way humans do. So the study has to be designed in a way to ensure that we get the best representation for potential human health hazards. Secondly, I am somewhat skeptical of the conclusions of that study, and again, this would be up for scientific review, and I have not reviewed the study, but the effects that were described by the gentleman from the previous testimony was an immediate effect to the heart muscle, which would suggest an acute response, which is different than something from a long-term exposure. So that suggests to me that the animal was probably overdosed and had a harmful outcome as a result of an acute exposure to a chemical as opposed to a chronic exposure. So that's very simple science coming out there, but that would be my interpretation of the study.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question for the author.
Senator Osmek.
We've heard commentary from these two testifiers about the possibility of the need to have this in the food service industry. Is that something you would be amenable to including within your exceptions under subsection 2?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, yes, and I've talked with them earlier today. I'm not sure exact wording. I talked with Senate Counsel about what wording one might use. This bill is scheduled for commerce, I think, in the next day or two, and I intended to have something before then if this committee, and I haven't spent more time. We met 2 hours before this committee started, sometime like that. And I think we should do some of that. I think they will say that they're not disagreeing with Department of Health or AMA about the residential type of use. I think their concern is specifically in the food processing and food handling, commercial food handling and processing type of thing. I'm certainly amenable to that. We may at some time say, hey, we don't need it there, but let's understep rather than overstep in terms of that. So, yes, I do intend to have something in there and happy to work on it tonight if you want or to try and work on it by tomorrow, I guess, whenever.
Senator Marty. Senator Osmek, that's good. Senator Marty, next up, any more questions for our folks from Ecolab? If not, Tony Quilis is here. Tony's a day early, you know. It's chamber day tomorrow for those of us here. So,
Mr. Chairman, we thank you. Tony Quilson, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Director of Environmental Policy, and you are correct. There will be a number of business people up here tomorrow. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman, and committee members for allowing me to testify on Senator Marty's bill. You have heard my spiel before. We're not big fans of doing state-by-state, chemical-by-chemical, especially being the first state in the nation to do this. And I wanted to point out also that Senator Marty has and shown, and I think, and I want to thank him for the exemption for the exemption for medical facilities, and also the talk, Senator Osmick, about how successful this product is, and from Ecolab, how successful this product is in preventing foodborne illnesses. So it shows that the product does work and is intended to do what it was supposed to do. But very quickly, also wanted to point out this, our days are all running together, but on March 8th, which I think was Friday, the Department of Health just released, they have a what's called the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program there, and they just announced that they are going to study triclocarbon. I apologize at this late hour. I can't read either, that they're going to do that. So I think this is the proverbial cart before the horse, if you will. We haven't even studied this or one of these at the Department of Health under the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program, yet we're going to ban the product. Two more things, Mr. Chairman, real quickly. The Department of Health has established some health-based values called HBVs for this chemical, for triclosan, excuse me. And those that limit for drinking water is at 50 parts per billion. And some of the studies that have been cited right now have been talking about 4.3 parts per billion. So it's almost a 10-time difference there between what the Department of Health has determined as safe for drinking water. And finally, Mr. Chairman, and we've had this conversation before on some of the other bills that have gone through here, there is not what I'll call the manufacturer retail drag. Right now, the business community has already, 2013 doesn't exist to the business community. We are into 2014. We have already manufactured products. They're on pallets. They have moved through the chain of commerce. And, Mr. Chairman, sometimes what we do in this case, what we've done in Senator Sieben and Senator Rest bills, is allow for the manufacturer and then the sale of it at retail at a different date. I just wanted to point that out to Senator Marty as this bill moves through the process. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Quilis. Any questions for our guest, Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was some discussion earlier about some companies, I think, if it was Johnson & Johnson, are planning by 2015 or something like that. And I was just wondering if perhaps the 2014 date is a little ambitious, if 2015 or moving it down the road would make some of the points that Mr. Quilis made, would help in that regard.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Weber. Senator Marty.
The reason put January of 2014 in the bill originally was to set a date and figure I'm going to be hearing probably a lot more tomorrow or whenever from businesses to do it because, yes, it does take time from when people order and so on. I think, and I'm here from others before this, and I assume that's tomorrow, I'm guessing probably a year out is more likely, which might mean July of 2014 or something. But I do want to hear from, I'm sure the retail folks will be here tomorrow, and Mr. Quilis represents them, among others, but I'm certainly open to it. I don't want to be too aggressive. On the other hand, I don't want to, I don't want people to be shipping back stuff that's in route to their warehouses and so on. I want to make sure they have appropriate time, and I'm welcome to suggestions.
Senator Marty, it's my understanding that this, if this passes tonight, it goes to Commerce tomorrow, I believe. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct.
So looks like it's going to be a good long night. Any other questions for Senator Marty? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves his Senate file number 1166 and referring it to Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Senator Marty, good luck tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and we can adjourn the committee in a second. I will be working on those two. I'm sure we may have other things as well, but
you voted yes
on those two provisions before tomorrow.
And members, we're here Thursday at 12 o'clock noon, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right. We are adjourned.